Hey everybody, welcome to the Linux Voice Podcast. It's season 4, episode 4. I'm looking around my office, there's no mould. The walls have been freshly painted and clean, and everything's great. How about you guys? Everything great over there? Ben?
Everything's great in Bristol.
Graham?
Everything's pretty good out here in Wiltshire.
Mike?
And here live on the scene in Upper Bavaria, things are pretty good. The listeners can't tell this, but Andrew's walking around and standing up whilst recording this podcast, so I think that's why he's bouncing with energy at the moment.
I too am standing up.
We hope that you're full of bouncy energy and stuff, dear listeners, because it's now time for, as I said, Series 4, Episode 4 of the Linux Voice Podcast. Still to come, we've got news, we've got halfway reminder, which will probably be about two-thirds of the way in, as is customary. We've got finds of the fortnight, we've got we may or may not have Vocalize Your Neurons, aka Speak Your Brains, aka the bits where people send stuff into Mike and he reads them out. We've got Voice of the Masters still to come. And there's a special section here with an asterisk. I'm just going to ignore that, pretend it doesn't happen. And we can all be pleasantly surprised by that a bit later on. If you like the sound of this, you can subscribe to a paper-based edition of the podcast. It's called a magazine. It's also called Linux Voice. It's available at loads of shops, I don't know, Barnes & Noble, maybe Sainsbury's, Tesco's. And also from shop.linuxvoice.com, where you can buy subscriptions.
Right, shall we move swiftly on with the news? First up, the item that's been dominating the headlines of the tech news this fortnight is Apple and their battle with the FBI. The FBI arrested some chap doing bad things, took an iPhone off him. And they want to get things off this iPhone, so they've taken it to Apple and said, we want to take things off this iPhone. Can you help us unlock it? And in order to do that, Apple would have to create a special version of iOS that allowed you to try and basically just bypass the passcode or guess lots of times without it locking you out. And Apple have turned around and said, no, that would be a step too far, giving the government too much power over our digital lives. And some people have come to Apple's support. Google and Facebook senior execs have said Apple are right. Some people have come to the FBI's defense and said, no, this is just defending a perpetrator's privacy rather than protecting the victim's right to justice. And much debate has ensued.
Bill Gates came out in support of the FBI, didn't he?
Well, Bill Gates then came out and said he was misquoted in supporting the FBI. What he actually wants is everyone to discuss the issue more widely.
I watched him say the words on the video.
Did you?
That's such a horrid, mealy-mouthed contribution to make. You know, when there's discussion taking place, for someone to pop up and say, oh, we need to discuss the issues, and then go away without saying what they think the issues are or what the right thing is. Yeah. You know, obviously, that's what we were doing before you popped up, Gates. Now, bugger off. Go back to doing whatever inconsequentiality it was you were doing before, like curing malaria.
It is. I think it is a difficult situation because Apple's main defence is that they don't want to introduce a backdoor into their products because that would, it's not just one case. That would then go on many, many times. However, everyone seems to be overlooking the fact that there's blatantly already a backdoor there, which allows them to put on the backdoor that the FBI want. Now, I'm not saying that I think Apple should do it. I think they probably shouldn't. But I am saying they should close the back door so that when the FBI come, they can just say, well, we can't do it.
Well, isn't the back door simply that they can force an update on the OS and get rid of...
They can force an update on the OS without the user accepting it, which to me, I don't think's right.
Yeah. I agree.
There should be no mechanism to update an OS without the user saying update. And if it didn't have that ability, then the entire discussion would be moot. Apple could just put their hands up and say it's impossible, jog on.
But also, doesn't it raise the question of how the phone's encrypted? Because as I'd always assumed that the code that you put in was the key that the data was encrypted with.
Yeah, but there's a block on it that basically, if you try the key too many times, it will wipe the device. Try too many guesses, and that's what FBI want to remove. Essentially, they want to be able to brute force the encryption.
Right, I understand, I get it.
Right. So like the way that Apple was so careless with its uploaded iCloud photographs, where you could just, if you had one piece of information, if you had a username, you could just keep cycling through passwords, that you can't do that on iPhones.
No, because, it depends on the settings, I believe, and the exact version of iOS you've got. But yeah, certainly on some versions, if you try the key too many times or try the passcode too many times, it wipes your device.
Well, if they tried his mother's maiden name and stuff like that.
Jihad, but with a
one instead of the I.
There's actually a weird twist to the case in that at some point, while the police have had the iPhone, they've changed the password on it. And no one seems to have explained how this has happened. If someone's like accidentally pocket dialed it, but somehow managed to change the the login key.
Amazing.
I guess it's no surprise what we think. I'm actually very impressed with Apple's response and the fact that the chief executive is willing to say definitively, unlike Bill Gates, that, you know, he thinks this is a bad idea and will set a bad precedent and they don't want to do it.
Yeah, because initially it came out of the FBI. I was like, oh, just let us do this one phone. It's a really bad guy and we promise we won't pest you again. Then it turns out they've pretty much just got a big stack of them waiting to go as soon as they agree to do one.
I mean, the only answer is really to be responsible and in control of your own encryption and, and have an encrypted folder on your phone yourself that only you can decrypt.
But how do you know that only you can decrypt it? What, do you have to write the software from scratch?
Well, I mean, the best that most of us can do, I suppose, is to use something like an open source version of Android and GNU PG or whatever an open source client is installed through F-Droid. Admittedly, without the skills to go through and look at the code ourselves, we can't be 100% sure, but that's the best option I can see.
Yeah. At least this does seem like a verification that modern encryption is not breakable by the US government.
Yeah, for now.
Unless it's all just security theatre and Apple has already complied and it's just doing this for the benefit of the shareholders. Which you would do. You would absolutely do that. You would never publicly say, yeah, okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's also this same disconnection that we've talked about before, that it isn't the answer. You know, the back door isn't going to make people safer. I mean, Bill Gates actually brings up the evil spectre of terrorists having chemical weapons and nuclear weapons in the near future. You know, and that's why he was suggesting that it was imperative that the FBI had access to communications. And, it's not going to solve the problem.
Yeah, I mean, the horse has bolted on the whole being able to spy on bad guys' conversations thing. Yeah. They're not there on iMessage going, lol, gonna bomb New York. You know, they're using their own systems that use strong encryption that don't have back doors. I mean, of course. But wouldn't you?
Didn't those attackers in Paris in November, weren't they using PlayStation 4s to communicate?
No, that was wrong information, and the source of the wrong information was slightly malicious as well. I can't remember now, but I think it was almost...
Was it that hacker 4chan?
No, I think it was almost some kind of authority wanted to undermine chat channels like the PlayStation 4 chat, even though there was absolutely no evidence of it being used, just to kind of instill a level of fear.
Uh-huh.
But it definitely wasn't that. But they were probably using WhatsApp. I mean, I want the security services to have as much power as they need to be able to do their job effectively. I just don't think this is going to be a solution.
No, and it would make us actually far more vulnerable.
I think so, yeah, yeah.
But if you ever want to be terrified about the prospect of terrorists with nuclear weapons, have a look on Wikipedia's list of lost nuclear weapons. It's terrifying. I genuinely don't understand how that happens. Oh, it was here a minute ago.
Oh, change of regime. Where did it go?
Yeah. Should we move on to some more security-related news?
Yeah.
It's quite a lot of security-related news, actually, this podcast. Next, security-related news. Linux Mint has had quite a major security breach, really. Some nasty pasty goes by the name Peace, broke into the Mint website and switched around the ISOs for Mint for ones that contained a backdoor. So if you downloaded Linux Mint on the 20th of February, you probably do have a backdoored version of Mint. So don't use it.
It has become huge news and also seems to have brought out an awful lot of hate towards Mint and the way the project is run. Apparently there's still a few hundred people. There are still a few hundred people who are part of the botnet that have installed. Thousands of people downloaded Mint that day, and a few hundred people are actually affected.
Yeah, I heard that. I suspected what actually happened was there's a few hundred security researchers running it in VMs to see what happens. But yeah, it is possible that some real users are still affected.
There's all kinds of things. I mean, also, didn't the hacker do some kind of exclusive interview with ZDNet?
Yeah, I saw that.
The whole thing, considering Mint, you know, has done an awful lot of good for the community. It's lots of people's chosen distribution. And, of course, this highlights the fact that they need to put some renewed emphasis on their own security. But also there's a wider problem that the MD5 checksums were there and they were wrong and nobody ever checks them. We as a community need a better solution for that. I don't think it should be as big a story as it has been. I think it's brought out a lot of embitterment for the way that people think that Mint does things, which is a bit unfair, I feel, after all the good that Mint's done over the years.
Yeah, but somebody was saying that Mint doesn't issue any security advisories and blacklist certain packages from being updated because they conflict with Debian Ubuntu. So if that's true, then it is a bit of an issue.
I mean, there's definitely some issues with Mint's security policy. How bigger issues those are really depend on your point of view. I mean, loads and loads of commercial vendors leave vulnerable software in the wild. I mean, there have been known issues on Windows and Adobe software for years that haven't been fixed. And people get on with those. But yeah, I mean, you're right. They should push out updates whenever possible. They're not always the quickest to push out updates for their stuff as well. But whether or not that affects your average home user is...
Do you think it deserves to be as big a story as it has been over the last few days?
Well, this sounds like quite a simple way of infecting people's computers, doesn't it? Switching two ISOs around it's very simple. It's very clever.
And basically got Clem's login details and switched over the ISOs like that.
Yeah, that's what they said in his ZNet interview.
Surely, if you could do that, if there was a version of iOS that had a backdoor. And a version that didn't have a bad door. It's only a you know, maybe a social engineering thing to.
No, because of the way you install the different things, things like iOS are signed by Apple, so they'll only install onto an Apple device if the digital signature matches Apple's public key, which comes on the device. But because of the way you install distros, that's not the case. You can just install anything. Although you could actually argue this is a case for secure boot. If your machine had Mint's keys installed on it, it wouldn't accept an ISO unless it was signed by Mint.
Yeah.
Although going back to the sort of the MD5 checking thing, there's actually... We shouldn't really be using MD5s for this as well either, because MD5s do have a collision issue, and it's a much more advanced attack, but it is possible to create a backdoored version of Mint with the same MD5 sum as a legitimate version, which is how the Flame malware spread. Obviously not with Mint, with a Windows update. But as you say, Andrew, that's what some attackers did to a Microsoft update they crafted a vulnerable version that had the same MD5 SOM as a legitimate update, so it matched the signature. And they used it to attack the Iranian uranium purification facilities. That's hard to say.
The other part that was funny was the interview with the hacker on ZDNet said they implied it was partly because it was open source that it was so easy to do, which was funny. Because, of course, all the code's available. It's really easy to roll your own distro and put in this malware. It's impossible with proprietary software.
Indeed. On a side note, I always hate the name ZDNet.
Yeah.
ZDNet. It feels like it should be ZNet, but it's not.
Yeah. I think Mint should possibly be a bit more transparent about it and declare what changes they're going to make. But I really hope they survive and continue to grow.
Yeah, I don't think this will be a major issue for them going forward. I mean, plenty of issues I've had.
Yeah.
Plenty of distros have had security issues and moved on from them. And it's more about the way they're handled than whether or not you have them.
Yeah.
Should we move on to our final security-related bit of news of the fortnight?
Yeah.
This is the glibc buffer overflow vulnerability that affects just about everything in Linux. glibc is like the core C library on Linux systems, and it's tied into almost any bit of software I can think of. So when it has
maybe
a
not
MicOS. I don't know, MicOS, is that vulnerable?
I wonder how much bigger, how many times, million times bigger glibc is than the entire MicOS. But no, we don't have any buffer overflows in our TCP/IP stack, we're proud to say.
Do you have a TCP/IP stack?
No. That's what makes it so great.
I think you're being modest, Mike. I've seen those RS-232 connections you make between two MicOS devices.
That's just serial. That's just Minicom. There's no network stack involved.
You can manually type in the TCP/IP.
So MicOS has a UART access.
Yeah, it's you can send bytes through serial ports quite easily. So you can use MicOS, connect through a null modem cable to another PC with a serial port that's running Minicom, and then log in and even browse the web in links. So MicOS makes a good dumb terminal.
But you can connect to loads of hardware using UARTs. You could add GPS receivers and all sorts. In fact, you can connect to the cell network through a UART.
Really?
Yeah, you can make a mobile version of MicOS.
Wow.
I think I've got...
All right, then.
I think I've got a bit of hardware somewhere, yeah. And then you just send...
AT commands.
Yeah, AT commands over UART.
Like, this is great. I'm going to do a 24-page tutorial in the next Linux Voice about this.
Cool. That's that issue sorted.
Yeah. But should you do that, were you to use the DNS resolver of glibc...
Good work.
You would be vulnerable to a buffer overflow attack. So this came out about a week or so ago as we're recording this. So basically the usual procedure applies: update all the things, restart all the things, get everything running.
Has this vulnerability got a name yet? You know, all the
doesn't.
Big ones have names now.
No, it Heart doesn't have a cool name.
We should think of one. Any suggestions, listeners?
I've got nothing.
But yeah, vulnerabilities in core libraries like this are quite an issue. And it makes me think as well about containers. Everybody's mad about containerizing everything. The more containers that have their own versions of libraries, the more that you've got to keep each one up to date. You know, the good benefit of dynamic linking is that you just fix your C library and everything's fixed. I don't know if containers have the ability to share outside C libraries these days. I'm not that clued up on it, but if every container has its own glibc and you've got to go around and patch them all, then that's even more work.
Not necessarily. I mean, if you're running a large number of machines, you should be able to automate this across the lot of them. That's just about provisioning properly. You should be able to sit somewhere in one place and say, massive glibc update, go. and it'll just do it. And all the issues, I mean, depending on your system, you may wish to do testing or whatever before pushing out that update. But yeah, as long as you're set up properly, containerization shouldn't really cause an issue with that.
Okay.
I mean, if you're going around 1,000 containers, SSHing into each one and typing yum update glibc, then you've got bigger problems than the fact that you're using containers.
Yeah.
I mean, the good side of this story is that I think I read the blog post by Google. Was it Google who announced its discovery and its fix and the fact that they'd created a theoretical vulnerability? It's a really subtle and difficult problem with glibc that kind of created this issue. And when they got in touch with other people, or other people told them about it, they'd been working on it for months to try and sort out, find exactly what this problem was. I think it was the Fedora team had already noticed it quite independently and had been themselves working on a fix. So in two separate cases, even though this is a very subtle bug that had been around for many years, there were two teams working on solutions because they could access it and see that this was a serious enough problem, which is good.
Yeah, sort of gives you faith that there aren't too many other bugs.
Yeah.
Two people notice this one.
And the many eyes thing, you know.
Yeah. There's probably a statistical analysis you can do on the probability of two people finding the same bug based on the number of bugs there are.
Yeah. But it was, I mean, I couldn't really understand it. It was incredibly subtle. It was only ever triggered under very specific circumstances.
Yeah, it came up because of an SSH problem, didn't it?
So it was a side effect, yeah.
Yeah, someone's trying to SSH into a particular server and it just kept crashing.
Yeah,
and it just turned out that it was a buffer overflow. Okay, let's leave security behind us now and move on to happier waters. Well, slightly happier. Android is switching to OpenJDK, which in itself is a good thing. You know, it's switching from sort of previously Apache licensed sort of implementation of Java to a GPL licensed version of Java. But the reason for this is horrific. It's because of Google's patent nonsense over copywriting APIs. And by using the GPL, by using the OpenJDK that was released by Oracle, they're protected by the GPL for any changes they make. Whereas previously they were using a re-implementation under the Apache license, which was released by Apache, the Apache Foundation, and so wasn't protected from the release from Oracle under the GPL. And it just goes to show the nonsense that goes around.
It's not aiding innovation, you mean?
Yeah, it's not. Oh, it's just petty nonsense. That's all it is. I mean, come on.
Petty nonsense. There's a title for this podcast.
Yeah, let me write that down.
I mean, what? Oh. I mean, the whole the court case, it was a few years ago now, where Oracle decided they wanted to copyright the Java APIs, and they went ahead and tried to sue Google, and the court supported it, and it went on, and it just up and down, in and out, and nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. I mean, the fact that there's a solution to this is quite good, but the solution, this shouldn't be the solution. You should be able to create a re-implementation of APIs regardless of whether or not the company has released them under the GPL previously.
Yeah.
This isn't the right solution to that problem, but it is good news for the OpenJDK. It means it'll get more work and more developer eyes.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I mean, we've talked about it quite a lot in the past, and it is depressing. I don't really know what to say. I don't know. The way things are going, it's getting worse. You know, whenever anything leads to litigation, it seems that the actual technical merit and advantages, and even the common sense advantages of being able to re-implement an API, seem completely lost. And everything goes down to the lowest common denominator of who's got enough money to throw at a problem. Now, Oracle's going to be prepared to fight tooth and nail, whatever it wants, because it probably, you know, sees Java as one of its main IPs. So there's just no win situation, especially for innovation.
Yeah, I can kind of see how this could actually be even worse than that, because this could actively discourage people from releasing
Yes.
Code.
Yeah. Make things more closed.
Yeah.
Because you could do it in private, and as long as you don't, you know, publish it.
Yeah. Yeah, if they hadn't released the OpenJDK, if Java had always been closed source,
yeah,
then Google would still be under the cosh for this.
Is there any performance advantages in OpenJDK?
No idea. Maybe. Guess it depends how many man hours you spend working on the performance. Mm. My guess is that Google have put so much effort into optimizing their previous implementation that it would be a slowdown to go to OpenJDK, JDK, but I don't know that
at
for
least
sure.
Initially.
Yeah.
But there are several examples of this with Oracle, and it's annoying. It's the same with MySQL, and it's the same with OpenOffice.org.
Yeah.
And possibly VirtualBox, which has lost loads of its software engineers.
Yeah, I'm thinking of ditching VirtualBox. But it is just so easy to use VirtualBox.
Yeah.
I do package it up really nicely.
Yeah.
It's just a really nice...
It is.
Whole application.
Vert Manager isn't bad, but...
Yeah. Right, should we move on to the final bit of news this fortnight, and a bit of happier news. The Indian government has rejected software patents. They've said that you can copyright software, that's fine, but you can't get a patent unless it's a real thing, a physical product.
Wow, common sense.
There was common sense from the Indians 2 weeks ago, wasn't there? When they didn't, the Indian government decide not to allow that Facebook walled garden thing.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yes.
Yeah. Excellent work.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's move to India.
Yeah,
it'd be a bit.
I hear the weather's better.
Ben's done cycling tours in India. We'll be all right. So that is excellent. So not enough money put into lobbying by the big corporations there.
Oh, don't give them ideas.
So these software-only patents, is that the same as, a clock has existed in physical reality for ages, and then someone now tries to come along and say, this is a clock, but I'm doing it in software, so it's my idea.
Exactly. I mean, the really famous example of this is probably the shopping cart patent. So when you are on Amazon or whatever web shop you use and you click add to cart, I mean, really it should be add to trolley, but anyway. that process of having a thing in which you put stuff before you go to pay for it is patented in software, despite the fact that it's clearly
amazing.
A shopping trolley.
But not in India.
But not in India. Well, I say it's patented. It's sort of disputed. It's being battled up and down at the moment by various
people.
It's almost
as if.
But some guy. So it has been patented, and some guy claims it's still patented. Some people claim it's not.
It's almost as if the Indian government is acting in the interests of its homegrown software industry.
I know, it's shocking.
What do they think? Don't they know how it works?
Has nobody briefed them?
I bet Trump won't let them get away with it.
Build a wall around India. enough.
So that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent, thank you, Ben. So that leads us to finds of the fortnight. I did ask the IRC channel. And there's been a few finds. Devilment says that he's been using silentpcreview.com for many years when building new PCs that are going to be in a communal area. So that's a recommendation for a service that sells hardware. It's easy hardware that doesn't make much noise, I'm guessing. And an oldish find relating to Mike's ARM tutorial from a couple of issues back. You could list out all the opcodes on RISC OS for ARM assembly. Help start square bracket lists all the opcodes for the CPU. Another one, E and go is going to click on the BBC link. It's in, but it's something about Jeremy Clarkson. Matthew 1471 says, here's a find. Himawarapi is a Python 3 script that fetches near real-time, 10 minutes delayed, pictures of the Earth as it's taken by the Himawari 8 satellite and sets it as your desktop background. That sounds very cool. Yeah.
That is a brilliant find.
So how frequently do the pictures appear? Can you have it like 10, at like 10 frames a second or something?
Well, it says there's a 10-minute delay picture of Earth, so maybe that's for like bandwidth reasons.
Okay.
I'll put that link in the podcast notes. McPhail, might be too late, but I found that you can read IMAP email with curl. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
If you ever need to.
Is that a bit like browsing the web with Telnet? It's technically possible. Yeah. Incredibly tough.
Chemist 69. Oh, there's a couple of new people here today. Thanks for your find. My find, for a number of terminal commands, adding the hyphen H option outputs file sizes in a human readable form. That's true. I use that a lot. Things like disk free hyphen H and disk use DU hyphen H.
Those are the two I was thinking of.
Enom, Dekel, I've been listening to two newish Python podcasts recently. Both started last March and both have great theme tunes. I think these are the names of the podcast: Python dot underscore underscore init underscore underscore and Talk Python to Me.
This one's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it?
And not very easy to Google for, I assume.
Yeah.
Jack, are the only reason people listen to us is because they like Brad Sucks?
Possibly. I think a lot of... Remember we suggested, a few years ago, we suggested about changing it, and we had like 100 comments saying, please don't change it. So now we can't ever change it. They're the finds from the IC channel. Thank you. Does anyone else want to have a go?
Can I have a go?
Of course you can, Mike.
Just because I've got this webpage open here, and it's a blog post that I found yesterday, and I was really excited to read it out on the podcast. Now I realize it's from 2012, so maybe someone else has already mentioned this in one of our previous lives. But the this blog post is called Exploring Expressions of Emotions in GitHub Commit Messages. And it's basically GitHub chucked 7 million commit records onto Google's BigQuery web service ages ago, 4 years ago. And then this guy has gone through and searched for different words and then looked at which programming languages are associated with certain words. So, for instance, he goes with anger and he looks at words like bar, angry, annoyed, appalled, bitter, cranky, hate, hating. And it turns out that Vim's scripting language is by far the language that causes the most anger and hate amongst developers, which is impressive in that it makes up only a very tiny proportion of the code on GitHub.
But could that be that there's just one really angry Vim script developer and he's just pushed the stats way out?
Well, quite possibly, yeah. I mean, we'll put the link in the podcast notes so people can look at these graphs. But it looks like PHP, C-sharp, and Ruby developers have the less problems with anger. Then he looks at joy, words like yes, yay, hallelujah, hooray, bingo, excited, glad. And Objective-C and PHP are the languages that make people happy, apparently. Again, Vim scripting language is the least successful in there. What else are there? Surprise, when he looks for yikes, gosh, baffled, stumped, shocked, and Perl comes up top there.
Is that because everyone's just surprised by Perl code?
I think so.
Bloody hell, that works.
And then there's one for swearing, which, of course, I won't read the words out, but surprise, surprise, Vim L comes out on top again. So maybe that supports your theory, Ben, that there's actually just a handful of people who code Vim script and just utterly, utterly hate it.
How does Python do on them?
Let's have a look. Python, in terms of swear words, Python is the third least used, least associated with swearing. Let's find happiness. Where was happiness? I remember. Oh, joy. Where does Python come with joy? In about the middle.
Okay.
So, yeah, above C++ and C#, but less than C, funnily enough. Programmers seem to be happy.
I was wondering how C did.
You what, Ben? You were wondering?
I was wondering how C did. C is a language that always makes me angry because I find it so hard to debug. It's always tiny, little, subtle things. And by the time I finally find what it is, it's just driving me mental.
Yeah, well, going back to the expressions of anger commit messages, C comes second there after the Vim scripting language. So probably, like you say, lots of tricky bugs to do with pointers and yeah. But it's worth a read. I mean, it's obviously a little bit dated now, and you know how scientific the methods are remains to be seen. But it's just quite entertaining because you can imagine different sorts of programmers and different languages bringing out different feelings in people. And that's my find. Cool.
Anyone else want to have a go?
Shall I go?
Go for it.
I've got a couple of finds this fortnight. One is Shashlik. I think we might have actually mentioned this before, but I've only just remembered that we might have mentioned it before. And it's a way of running Android apps on a Linux desktop. It's basically a really stripped down version of Android that sort of runs alongside a regular Linux thing, and you can then run Android apps in a window. So if you want to run, I don't know, a particular thing that doesn't have an easy use on Linux, and you've got
that's
that.
Great. Can you run Google Play Store?
I don't know, actually. Maybe. It won't run everything because it doesn't translate ARM to x86. So whatever you run has to have an x86 version.
Yeah,
and that's not all apps, but that can come in handy from time to time. Another thing I've come across, which I found quite interesting, is TermPix, which is it's really simple. It's only like 100 lines of code or something. I had a look at the source, but it's a image viewer for the terminal. So basically, it converts images, JPEGs, PNGs, etc., into because there's a half block character that you can set to a color in strings, so you get sort of this. It's not 8-bit graphics, but it looks like 8-bit graphics from in your terminal from any image file. It's one of those things that's completely useless, but actually looks quite cool.
Well, I believe it or not, I have actually used one of those, and it goes back to when I was using a Texmo web browser at Munich Airport ages ago because my connection was so bad. So I was SSH'd into a Raspberry Pi, just browsing Wikipedia, and I thought, well, what happens if I tap an image? And it rendered the image using one of these ASCII art image renderers. And it, like you say, it was almost impossible to actually make out what was in the image with such a low resolution. But I thought, oh, respect for the browser for trying at least.
Anyway, you had a bad web connection, so you SSH'd into another device and used that to browse the web.
Yeah, because the SSH'ing into a Raspberry Pi means that you only get screen updates then. You know, if I was trying to access a website, even with links on my laptop, then I'd still have to download the site. But by SSH'ing in, I was then browsing using, well, it's W3M actually, and so all that was coming to my laptop were the page with the screen updates, so just a few characters here and there. So I could actually browse the web and read Reddit while everybody else was punching their laptops around me and getting really angry. It was great.
Yeah, I can see how that worked. Was it not an issue with scrolling a lot?
Well, yeah, when you had to scroll the full page. I mean, my connection rate was about 1 kilobyte a second. So that was enough to reflow a page in the terminal, you know, without any major issues. But yeah, Linux saves the day again.
Whenever I get stuck and I'm bored with a really slow internet connection, I just look up Ask Reddit threads on my Reddit app on my phone. And you just get a load of text to read. Or Hacker News actually works the same.
Yeah.
And my last find this fortnight is I finally found what it's like to have the flu. I genuinely don't think I've had the flu before. I've had plenty of colds, but this time it was brutal. I had a fever and I was just shivering in bed for 2 days. And then...
Are you feeling better now?
Yeah, I'm pretty much over it. Still got a little bit of a cough, but nothing really.
Yeah.
But I was amazed by how bad it was. My fiance came back and said, I think this might not just be a cold, this might be the flu. And he said, yeah, you do look like you would die if this was Victorian times.
It's proper nasty, isn't it? I had the flu once, and it was December the 30th, 1999. So I couldn't even go.
Maybe it sucked. Maybe it was because it was then, though.
Oh, yeah. Maybe it was that was the millennium.
You say Mike had the millennium bug.
Oh, no. Yeah, I've had it once. We all think... I couldn't get off the floor. I literally couldn't get off the floor.
You should be old a week and then you get the jab for free like I do.
Yeah, but even then, you've only got... It's only like the most virulent virus from the previous year, isn't it? There's only like a 30 or 40% chance that it'll stop. Okay, so I've got a couple of fines. One of my fines is related to the cardboard camera app that I've been was like so enamored with last time. I've been taking a few more shots with it, and I've been thinking about how it's been working, because I originally thought that maybe it was constructing a 3D model, and now I've decided that it can't be doing that. What I think it's doing is quite, and I really have no idea, this is pure conjecture, but I reckon it's basically doing a vertical scan line. So if you weren't listening last time, this is a Google's cardboard camera app that takes basically 3D panoramas you can look at in VR or look at on your phone. And the 3D, I think, comes from basically taking a picture of the left, a scan line, a vertical line for the left eye from the left side of the lens, and a vertical line for the right eye from the right side of the lens. And as it does these scan lines, as you move your camera around, it eventually joins up and overlaps. So it creates. So if you think about it, the vertical side of the left eye is here. You move a few inches to the right. You've now got the other side of the left eye image on the right hand side of the lens. Anyway, I don't think there's any 3D generation involved. It's creating two images from the displacement of the lens. It's still brilliant. I should put one of the photos up on the website, so that even if you haven't got the app, you could try it. Another find, isn't a specific find, but I used an ancient tutorial from Linux.com, I think, to add whitelists to PostFix on my own email server to create basically a lockdown email mainly to avoid spam, but so that you can only receive emails from specific email addresses. And the tutorial is really good, really well written, and somebody's updated it and put some code into GitHub that changes all of it and gives you the configuration files and also a simple PHP app for adding your own. You basically just have to play around with a bit of MariaDB and PostFix configuration files, which are horrendous. If you've ever configured PostFix, and you kind of leave it for a year, you never want to touch those files again because it's just black magic. But it creates a really nice system if you find that you need a system like that. And I did, and it works. It's really useful. I'll put the links in the notes. And the other one was I was on Linux Unplugged last night, which was good fun, actually. It was good being part of it. I really like the way that they do it with their Mumble servers, and you can kind of just slot yourself into the conversation. And anyway, one of their finds, so I'm stealing it from them, is the Actor messaging platform, which is like, I think it's been around for over a year, but it's like Telegram, with the exception that I think even some of the source code is from Telegram. But the server code is also open source, so you can host your own Actor messaging platform server, which I think is good and got lots of great potential. It's the only thing that kind of stops me from recommending things like Telegram and WhatsApp when you can't trust the code fully. And of course you can't without having the skills to be able to look at the encryption that they're using, but I still think it's a great step forward. I've not tried it, but then the API has just gone 1.0 in January, and there's a Linux client available for it as well as a web client.
So what advantage does that have over something like Jabber?
What Jabber with GNU PG encryption.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to worry about the GNU PG encryption.
Ah, so it's encrypted by default.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like Telegram or WhatsApp.
Okay.
It's basically, cool. and it has the same kind of grouping and group chat facility. I think it's very similar to Telegram in that way that everybody seems to be using Telegram these days. Yeah, Jabber, you kind of missed the opportunity, really, on those things, or XMPP. I think they're my finds.
Okay, is it time for my find?
Yeah.
Right, I'm going to put the mic down. This needs two hands.
This is why you've been standing up.
Look, it's a package.
Ooh.
From Sheffield.
Andrew is opening the package right now. We can see he really is actually pulling the polythene off the UPS packaging.
Like Christmas.
It's quite exciting.
It is exciting. I have no idea what it is.
It's from Pimeroni.
It's from Pimeroni. Yeah. It's like a. Did you win one of the competitions?
It's lovely.
Oh, it's Flotilla.
So, Flotilla, friendly electronics, includes over 20 awesome. Projects. Build a synth, robot, or digipet. I'm not too fussed on digipet.
You can build a synth?
Yeah. I could then sell it to Graham for £1,000.
Yeah. Oh, if I had £1,000, you could have it.
Yeah, so there's loads of cool stuff in there. Packaging, I mean, the packaging is lovely. It's really lovely.
They do an amazing job with design. I know that design is in their DNA, but it's so beautiful, isn't it?
That must be Paul's work.
Yeah, Paul is phenomenally talented.
So pretty. So yeah, so this is an add-on thing for the Raspberry Pi.
Is it specifically for the Raspberry Pi, or can you just whack it into any computer?
I really don't know yet, but I've got a Raspberry Pi, and that's what I intend to use it with.
Yeah.
The way that Paul explained it to me was that this is Paul Paul Beach. Who is one of the heads?
Is he the pirate, the monkey, the robot, or the ninja?
I don't want to say. He looks to me a bit like a monkey, but a friendly monkey. The way he explained it is that it helps cut down the time between having an idea and testing the idea out, so that it provides an interface between the computer and your brain when you think, oh, I wonder if I could try this out, or you know, see if this works. And then you download your GPIO zeros and you try and fiddle things out, and you just get a bit stuck, or I get stuck anyway. It's not for advanced people, I don't think, but for people who've got a little bit of curiosity and an idea and want to see if they can make it work, then that's what this is. And I'm really looking forward to using some of my extensive spare time to try things out. Probably the allotment. I reckon there'll be some sort of weather station going on.
With a little synthesizer.
Yeah. And a digipet.
Yeah. Wow.
Probes in the ground to monitor how much moisture is in the soil.
I have one of those probes. Actually, this is my rain sensor that's ready for the garden. And somewhere on this mess of a desk, I have my soil moisture sensor. Yeah, because I had exactly the same idea, although not with a Flotilla. I'm going to use one of my Node MCUs that I now have hundreds of because they're only £2 each.
So you're a lot more advanced than I am. I need a bit of hand-holding, which is exactly what I'm hoping this will give me.
If you can use it with MicOS, you could use a UART to connect it to GSM, and send the data over the mobile network.
Yeah, I'm sure my team can work on that, Andrew, for a small development fee.
No, I'm going to just get that deranged 14-year-old to do it instead. So that's my discovery. Other discoveries are just inconsequential, really. Let's move on.
And they are our finds. The mic, your mic's gone screwy again, Andrew. Yeah, it's the same problem. Can't hear you. Oh, it's on mute.
It's not on mute, but we can't hear you.
This is the Cursed Podcast. Oh, yeah, it's working.
Awesome. Well, that brings us rumbling on to the halfway reminder. Still to come, there may or may not be a voice of the masses. No, there will be a voice of the masses, but there may or may not be some neurons to vocalise. Mike, are there any neurons?
He's gone to check his lasagna.
He's empty chairing us. It's all the rage these days. If you don't agree with someone's opinions, you just put an empty chair or a tub of lard in their place. And then they can't infect you with their free speech. So, Mike,
hello.
How's your lasagna?
It's about another 10 minutes away, so if we can squeeze in the rest of the podcast.
Yeah, neurons.
Sadly, nobody sent me any neurons this fortnight. They tend to
Are you just saying that so you can get to your lasagna?
No, it's actually true. They tend to come in batches. Sometimes I get like five at once full of XML code to read out, and then I'll get nothing. But if anybody does want their opinion read out on the show, email me mike@linuxvoice.com.
Short and sweet. I like it. Thanks, Mike. That brings us soaring majestically like the Andean condor onto the voice of the masses. What's your favourite desktop and why? Mike, what's your favourite desktop and why?
XFCE, because it's awesome. I've been using XFCE now for about 5 years, and I just like the simplicity, the speed of it. It integrates well with other GTK apps. And yeah, unless the team does anything completely stupid, like try and redesign it for 32-inch touchscreens, then I'm going to stick with it.
Free Tom agrees. He says he likes XFCE because it's just light enough to be as fast as possible without resorting to sub-WinXP levels of desktop functionality. That said, I also like it to be nicely modded beyond its defaults by a distro maintainer. Mint XFCE is a perfect example. Now, we've often said this about KDE, haven't we? In its default state, it's not too good, and it needs it needs a Mageia or a Rosa or somebody to tweak it and make it better.
Yeah. Takes up a load of RAM as well, though, KDE. That's the nice thing about XFCE, is that you get all that without the overhead.
Yeah, Dale McGee likes XFCE because it's lightweight, functional and configurable, runs faster than my gaming rig and also on my clunky old laptop, but mostly I like it because it gets out of my way. Yeah, I second that. The getting out of your way is very, very important. That's why I like Cinnamon and Mate. Mate in particular. I never have to think about it unless I'm being corrected on its pronunciation. It just exists. It's another ground. It provides a layer in which, you know, useful applications can sit, and I never even know it's there. That's why I like it. Viking Penguin, having tried all sorts of distros, I found I'm turning back to XFCE again and again, maybe because it feels like home.
The comments were really great, weren't they? Because I was expecting a bit of a flame fest, but there's none of that at all. It's just really cool.
Yeah. It's like people have just grown up over the last 5 years or so, realised that there are far more frightening things out there in the world.
Yeah, like Unity.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with Unity.
Yeah.
Well, there are plenty of things wrong with it, but I still use it.
And is your favourite desktop, Ben?
It's certainly the one I use the most, so I guess, yes, it's my favourite desktop. Yeah, I honestly couldn't say why, to be honest. Maybe I've just become indoctrinated. Maybe I've just used it so much everything else seems strange. But it's one of those things that I don't know why I like it, but when I change to a different desktop, I always feel like I don't like it. There's something, I don't know, maybe I just like big square icons. And I like the fact that it is set up by default, and that's how it is. I don't like to tweak my desktop. I just like it to look good and work, and it does that. And I also like the, I can't even remember what they call it. Is it the dash in Ubuntu, or do they call it something else? Where instead of having a hierarchical menu, I always lose things in menus. I can never remember which menu. Is it a system thing? Is it a utility? Is it a whatever? Whereas this, you just click on the what's it and type the thing and it pops up. I don't know, you can get that on other distros as well, or on other desktops as well. But the fact that it's sort of, it's the heart of Ubuntu, it's not something tacked on top, it seems to work really well.
Now, the dash thing, is that down the left-hand side? Can you configure that?
I might be using the wrong word, because I always forget what the name call it and what Ubuntu call it, but the dash is the bit that you click on that you search for applications in. And then there's the launcher panel thing down the left-hand side. And you can change what applications are in it, but you can't move it or change its size. I don't think you can even easily change its color.
Right. So this brings us on to an excellent point from Benz, who says, KDE 4 for its configurability. Now, whenever people talk about KDE being configurable, I always sort of, part of me thinks, you know, what's the point? You're just mucking about with stuff. It's still just as functional at the end of the day. But he's got a great example of a concrete example of why configurability is good. So here we go. Years ago, I decided that the desktop was fundamentally broken. We may acquire information from left to right, but how we manipulate our tools is based on handedness. Someone was thinking reading versus manipulating physical objects, and most people are right-handed. My coffee cup is not on the left side of my desk because I'm right-handed. Same with a mouse, pen, paper, phone, whatever. When I'm working in the garage, I place my tools on the right side of the bench. I find it much easier to mouse the right side of the desktop rather than reach all the way to the left. KDE lets me fix this to varying degrees. My panel is vertical right side. I also like the key launcher combinations. LibreOffice gets kudos for the same reasons. Toolbars are vertical down the right side.
A really interesting point.
Torvalds rant, stop treating users like idiots. You know, that's not helpful to anybody. That is an actual concrete, useful, reason for KDE's existence, which I've never seen before now.
I'm just thinking about that. It's an interesting idea, though I'm not sure I completely agree with it, because having something on the left side of your screen isn't the same as having it on the left side of your desk. It's because you don't have to reach across to the other side of your screen. You just twiddle your mouth a little bit.
You don't, but it may be more intuitive.
Maybe.
If the desktop is a visual metaphor for a physical desktop, then I don't know, maybe. It doesn't bother me. But then I don't spend a lot of time switching between applications. You know, if I'm in working in LibreOffice, then I'll probably be there for a while. I don't need to flip back and forth between things. Whereas if you had an editor open and then you were pulling quotes out of, I don't know, Stack Overflow or something, copying and pasting bits, looking stuff up on Google, then you would be doing that.
Yeah, but, well, certainly when I do that, I just flip between windows. I alt-tab rather than having stuff on one side of my screen and pulling it over to the other. I don't know. It's an interesting idea.
Right, so some more outlandish choices now. Frank says, it's not a desktop, it's a Flexbox. Without a bunch of extraneous, superfluous lights flashing, bells clanging and whistles whistling. My next favourite is Enlightenment. I like KDE programs, but don't need the sequined velvet suit that is the KDE environment. Mate is okay and Gnome is just annoying. Do you feel like you're wearing a sequined velvet suit, Graham?
Well, I wasn't going to say too much because of the 2 minutes that I did in the last episode. I had a few emails about that. A couple of people trying it out as a result of those 2 minutes, and a couple of people who tried it out and it still wasn't for them. I must admit, the most recent version, I'm having a few problems with stability with the window compositing. I think I did a tutorial in the Next Voice maybe over a year ago about pretty much how I make my KDE look. It looks pretty austere. I use like a material design and flat icon. So I do have wobbly windows, though.
When you made your pro KDE rant last podcast out, yeah. you did start off by saying that it's not for everyone, which is crucial to acknowledge. And the reason it works is that there are other desktops.
Yeah.
So KDE doesn't need to cater to, it doesn't need to be all things to all men. It can just plow its own furrow and be very good at it.
Yeah,
and it doesn't matter that I don't get it, as long as somebody does.
Eight years ago when we started this podcast, I think things felt a little bit more partisan. You know, we like to kind of pick, we like to say that there was a bit of a fight, but it really doesn't feel like that anymore. And I think the comments for this Voice of the Masses really say that out loud. You know, there's a pretty equal distribution of desktops that people have chosen, and all of them have been chosen for really good reasons that I would find it very difficult to argue with. You know, and that's the reason why I use KDE, really. It suits me, and I guess that's what motivates the developers into making KDE and making the other desktops as well. It's their own itches. And we're all different in interesting ways.
Now, here's something that we may not have seen or expected 8 years ago when we started this podcast back in the midst of time. So Frank says, mate is okay, gnome is just annoying. David G says, I don't like GNOME. Orange Dolphin says, I love GNOME 3 until it crashed on me. Francesco Turco does like GNOME. Rekios, Cinnamon is on my main desktop. There's nothing surprising about it. It just seems to work in the way I expect things to. I rather like the look of Budgie on Solus. If they use Cinnamon's Nemo file manager instead of the default GNOME one, it could usurp Cinnamon's place as my preferred desktop. Paul Olson, I had been a GNOME 2 user, but was very disappointed with GNOME 3. There's just a lot of people who feel sad and want to go back to 1954 when Britain was great.
But also, I don't just use KDE. I use other desktops a lot. I mean, I'm sat in front of, basically XFCE kind of Unity combination. I've got the XFCE window manager running on top of Unity.
And what?
Yeah, because I just didn't like the way that Unity was managing my windows.
Okay.
And yeah.
Okay, I've been unkind on GNOME 3. Lots of people like it. Electronic Penguin likes it. Vlad likes it. Stuart likes it. Idafi, Matt. Matt says, I hate clutter of any sort, but I'm rather real disciplined. GNOME 3 keeps me sane. No higher accolade than that. So everyone's got a favourite, which is lovely.
And I don't think there's any clear winner, is there?
No, I don't think so.
It's not KDE. I think
all winners.
Yeah, maybe it's closer to GNOME and Unity. Unity seems to have really, really become popular. I think the last 12 months or 18 months, people seem to have, you know, come to terms with it and what Canonical have been doing with it.
It took me quite a while to like it. I really didn't for a long time. I don't really know why I used it so long when I didn't like it.
But, was it one of our challenges?
Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe we should.
That's an interesting phrase. Come to terms with what Canonical has been doing with it. It's you know, a change to your desktop environment forced from above is a bit like Apple forcing on the latest U2 album when you don't really want it. You don't have to listen to it, but it feels like a bit of a violation.
I did switch. I used Cinnamon and Mate for quite a while before coming back to Unity. I don't know, maybe something changed inside me, but now I quite like it. Maybe it changed. I can't remember what it was like before.
Right, well, it seems like that's all the weather for now.
Cool. I think that was quite a long podcast.
Yeah. Value for money.
Oh, yes.
A bumper family-sized, hard-working family-sized podcast.
So next Voice of the Masses is going to be, shall we stay in the EU or not?
Cool.
We should mention that there's still some time to back Beep Beep PR. Yes. I think early next week is the it runs until the 29th of February, which is Monday. So it could still happen.
It could still happen. We know last podcast got, was it 5,700 downloads?
That's right.
So Beep Beep PR is now on 306 backers. So not all of you have fully bought into this yet. But, you know, give it a look, see what you think.
Yeah. Awesome. So we'll find out in 2 weeks' time.
Yes. Excellent. See you then.
Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.